time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, April the 12th, 2024. I'm Dave Buzik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Judith Linden. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. For this first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news, and then we'll wrap up our broadcast with the insights of Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Well, in the weather, there'll be two main weather stories as we go into the weekend and early next week. The first will be several days of dry conditions and warming temperatures with highs in the 60s today and then the middle 70s to lower 80s over the weekend. There should be nearly full sunshine today, but those winds will be brisk from the northwest, gusting as high as 25 to 35 miles an hour, and sometimes out of the northwest, and it says sometimes out of the northeast as well here. Although it will remain warm, chances for showers and thunderstorms return Monday and increase into Tuesday. A few of the storms may be strong to severe. Highs will be in the lower to middle 80s on Monday and then in the 70s on Tuesday. The outlook for later next week calls for a return to cooler, more seasonal temperatures. Here's the specific day part forecast. Today, sunny skies, still some gusty winds, high 66, winds out of the northwest at 15, gusting to 30. Tonight, mostly clear skies, low 40, winds out of the south-southeast at 10 to 15. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy, a high around 80, and as you might guess, winds out of the southwest, around 15 miles an hour, gusting up to 30. Saturday night, clouds temporarily increase as a front comes through, low of 56, winds shifting from southwest to northwest to 10 to 20 miles an hour. On Sunday, mostly sunny, high 85, winds becoming northwest to 10 to 15. And then on Monday, a chance of showers and storms, especially later in the day, a high near 85, winds out of the southeast at 15 to 20 miles an hour with gusts up to 30. So, feels warm and certainly kind of March winds lasting into mid-April here. Judith, good morning. Good to see you. You've been off for a couple of months. I'm not sure why you would want to leave Iowa in the middle of winter, but you know, that's between that's between you and your husband. So welcome back.
It's great to be back. I've had a little laryngitis, so we'll see how that goes. But Dave said he'll help me out if that needs to be. But I'm very, very happy to be back among you, dear listeners. First story. Abortion rights arguments parse previous rulings. High Court to decide if 2023 law is constitutional. This story by William Morris. Attorneys for Iowa and Planned Parenthood pulled out all their top arguments Thursday to battle over whether Iowa's most recent abortion law should go into effect. At issue is the law, passed last year in a special session, banning abortions after fetal cardiac activity is detected, approximately in the sixth week of pregnancy, before many women are aware they are pregnant. The law is currently blocked after a district judge ruled it likely unconstitutional, according to Iowa Supreme Court precedent. The state has appealed, and Thursday the justices heard nearly an hour of arguments from both sides. Solicitor General Eric Wesson for the state told the justices the court should hold that the state can restrict abortion access so long as it can articulate a rational basis for the challenged law. Attorney Peter Im for Planned Parenthood said that despite a 2022 decision finding abortion is not a fundamental right in Iowa, the court should still interpret the Iowa Constitution to forbid restrictions constituting an undue burden on abortion access. The court has struggled with the issue of abortion over numerous decisions over the past decade. Its latest decision, which advocates for the state, hope to settle the issue once and for all, is expected by the end of June. Much of Thursday's arguments revolved around what exactly the Iowa Supreme Court meant in its recent abortion rights rulings. The justices ruled in 2022 that Iowa's Constitution does not protect a fundamental right to an abortion, reversing its 2018 decision. That meant abortion laws were no longer held to the standard of strict scrutiny to determine if they were constitutional. But the court declined to rule on what the standard should be, leaving in place the undue burden standard from a 2017 case. A week after the 2022 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, similarly ending constitutional protections on the federal level. In response, Governor Kim Reynolds sought to revive the state's long-blocked ban on abortions after fetal cardiac activity is detected about 6 weeks into pregnancy. Lower courts declined to lift the stay, and Reynolds appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. But in 2023, the High Court deadlocked 3-3, leaving the law banned. In non-binding opinions, three justices, Edward Mansfield, Thomas Waterman, and Chief Justice Susan Christensen, indicated they might favor at least some legal protections for abortion, while Justices Matthew McDermott, Christopher McDonald, and David May argued for the more permissive rational basis standard. In response, Reynolds and the legislature passed the 2023 law, which was again blocked and once again appealed. This time, the court is joined by Justice Dana Oxley, who was recused from the 2023 case and could provide the tiebreaker vote if the other justices remain split on what the constitutional standard for abortion laws should be. What the attorneys argued: the court's 2022 decision revolved around the Due Process Clause of Iowa's Constitution and found that clause does not protect abortion. Before the court Thursday, M. suggested that there are other places in the Constitution where the court could also find support for an intermediate standard, such as the undue burden test. Autonomy and dominion over one's own body, that runs through the Iowa Constitution, he said. It is fundamental. Wesson, though, said past precedent is clear. If something is not a fundamental right, then the only standard for courts to use to evaluate restrictions is rational basis review. Wesson said, this court has never before recognized a quasi-fundamental or fundamental-ish right, he said, calling it a binary question. As for other constitutional provisions, M. argued, might protect abortion, Wesson said the appropriate test for those claims would be rational basis as well. Wesson said they are seeking a carve-out to treat abortion rights differently than other rights. Textually, there is no basis for a right to an abortion. What did the justices have to say? While justices' questions during arguments do not always forecast their eventual decisions, it appeared the 3-3 split from last year's decision endures. Those who favored rational basis review last year had skeptical questions for M., most notably Justice Christopher McDonald, who repeatedly pressed M. to point to any past cases where the court had adopted a similar intermediate level of constitutional protection for a non-fundamental right. The three justices who signed on for the undue burden standard last year were similarly skeptical of Wesson's case. Mansfield, who wrote the 2022 decisions, suggested the court might need to give greater weight to the Constitution's promise that men and women have equal rights, including enjoying and defending life and liberty, and pursuing and obtaining safety and happiness. Christensen pressed Wesson on whether the law's exceptions, including for the life and health of the mother, or in some cases of rape and incest, are broad enough to survive rational basis review. Oxley, the possible deciding vote, asked several questions, probing whether the district court should be allowed to rule on alternate grounds Planned Parenthood raised to block the law, and what kinds of evidence the organization expects to introduce if given the chance. Will this case finally settle abortion standard? The 2022 and 2023 abortion cases ended without answering the core question of whether and how the Iowa Constitution protects abortions. Conservatives on the court have repeatedly expressed frustration at that, and the state's attorneys are asking the court to finally resolve the issue. Planned Parenthood, though, has argued the court should kick the can down the road again. Reynolds appealed after the district court granted a preliminary injunction blocking the law, but before getting a final judgment. Although the outcome in district court is almost certain, the judge has said he does not have the authority to overrule Supreme Court precedent blocking the law. Planned Parenthood has asked the court to send the case back to let the litigation process play out. That would set up another appeal and likely push a final decision back at least another year. M said, pre-viability abortion has been legal in Iowa for 50 years. All we ask the court is to leave that status quo in place pending further argument below. Wesson said the Supreme Court should decide now that abortion laws are held to the more permissive rational basis standard and that the state will happily return to the district court to litigate whether the law is constitutional on those terms. He went on to say, what is most important, after years of litigation trying to determine the standard of review, that this court returns to its own test under the Due Process Clause and explains and holds that rational basis is the proper standard. State leaders are closely watching the case. Restricting abortions has long been a top priority for Reynolds, who said Thursday she hopes the court, most of who she appointed, will rule in favor of the heartbeat law. For Iowa, the people's elected representatives have drawn a clear line multiple times at when a heartbeat begins. Today, the unborn had their day at the Iowa Supreme Court, Reynolds said in a statement. As a pro-life governor, I will do everything I can to protect the innocent unborn and promote strong, healthy families. Democratic leaders are also following the court's action, and the party has also has offered a constitutional amendment that would explicitly protect abortion access in the state. Before Thursday's arguments, House Minority Leader Jennifer Converse, Democrat of Windsor Heights, said the law imperils the health and safety of Iowa women and criticized Republicans for, in her view, trying to dodge accountability for the repeal of Roe v. Wade. Converse said that's what the GOP wanted. Iowans need to know that. If you have concerns about reproductive freedom, if you're wondering what will happen if you find yourself in a dangerous pregnancy or a miscarriage and being unable to get the care you need, Republicans did this and Democrats are fighting back, she said. Attorney General Brenna Byrd said in a statement that no right is more sacred than the right to life and that, as the court deliberates, I am confident that the law is on our side.
And the second story of three on the front page of today's Des Moines Register on this Friday, April 12th, headline, Iowa Senate votes to let teachers carry guns. The bill also requires officers in some high schools. This story by Stephen Gruber Miller of the Register. Teachers and other school employees would be able to obtain professional permits to carry guns on school grounds under a bill passed Wednesday by the Iowa Senate. The Senate voted 30-14 to pass House File 2586. Senator Charlie McClintock, a Republican from Al Burnett, joined every Democrat in opposition. Every other Republican voted in favor. The bill also requires Iowa's largest school districts to employ school resource officers in their high school buildings. Because the Senate amended the legislation, the bill goes back to the House, which passed it in February. Republicans proposed the measure as part of their response to the deadly shooting at Perry High School in January, when a high school student shot and killed sixth grader Amir Joliffe and Principal Dan Marburger, and wounded half a dozen others before fatally shooting himself. Republican Senator Chris Conoyer from LeClaire said, "Seconds count when law enforcement are minutes away, even in the quickest response. In most mass shootings, the shooting stops when the good guys show up. The bad guy with the gun is stopped by the good guy with the gun." Gun violence prevention groups have held protests and spoken out against the bill, saying it will make students and school employees less safe by increasing the likelihood of accidents involving guns in schools. Chloe Geyer, a volunteer leader with Drake University Students Demand Action, said in a statement that lawmakers' response to the Perry shooting is, quote, the definition of insanity. She said, guns are turning our schools into graveyards, and yet Iowa lawmakers are hell-bent on arming our teachers as a response. It literally defies all common sense, she said. A 2023 report from the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence documents about 100 incidents of guns being mishandled, left in reach of children, or accidentally discharged at schools over the past 5 years. More than 30 states allow teachers or other K-12 school staff to be armed, or at least in at least some circumstances, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. The Tennessee State Senate also passed a measure on Wednesday that would allow a similar policy. Those who want to carry firearms will be required to go through a permit process. It includes one-time in-person legal training that covers qualified immunity, emergency medical training, and communication training, as well as quarterly firearm training and annual live scenario training. That process would be approved by the Iowa Department of Public Safety. The legislation allowing school employees to obtain professional permits to carry firearms applies to K-12 public and private schools, community colleges, and public and private colleges and universities. The identity of a staff member who has a professional carry permit would be confidential and exempt from Iowa's public records law. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll conducted in February found 60% of Iowans favored allowing teachers and other staff to carry firearms in schools after completing training. 38% opposed the policy, and 1% were not sure. The legislation builds on a previously passed law that let school employees carry firearms but did not require districts' insurers to cover them. Two Iowa school districts in recent years have approved arming their staff before later reversing their policies. Spirit Lake and Cherokee both opted not to go forward after EMC Insurance declined to cover the rural districts ahead of the 2023-24 school year if they armed their staff. Last year, House lawmakers passed a bill that would have barred insurers from denying coverage to districts based solely on the district's decision to arm their staff, but that measure failed in the Iowa Senate. Republicans on Wednesday of this week emphasized that the bill leaves it to school boards to decide whether their districts will choose to arm school employees. Senator David Rowley, a Republican from Spirit Lake, said Spirit Lake, as well as 19 other school districts in Iowa, have expressed interest in arming their school staff. He said, "This bill gives a willing school district the option to have a strategic plan in place and for them to immediately respond in the event that it does happen there." In a statement on Wednesday, EMC Insurance said it shares, quote, a deep commitment to the health and safety of students and that it respects schools' right to choose the policies they believe to be in their best interests. The statement went on to say, we believe this legislation could attract more insurance carriers to Iowa, along with potentially more options for schools to find coverage that meets their needs. This would be a positive outcome for all. EMC said the company will continue offering insurance to school districts that use school resource officers or law enforcement for their security. Quote, EMC will continue to insure schools that provide on-site armed security utilizing trained law enforcement or school resource officers consistent with our policy in all statements. The EMC statement went on to say, we will also continue to explore other options in light of changing marketplace conditions, unquote. The bill would give qualified immunity to armed school staff with professional permits, protecting them from civil lawsuits or criminal prosecution if they used reasonable force and acted within the course of their duties. Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames, said the qualified immunity leaves families with no one to hold accountable if their loved ones are injured or killed by an armed school staff member. Senator Kornbach said, the student who may suffer permanent injury, the student who may be killed, their parents, their family, have no one from whom to collect any kind of financial compensation. Kornbach called the immunity from criminal prosecution a get-out-of-jail-free card for the employee or school resource officer. Senator Julian Garrett, a Republican from Indianola, said qualified immunity exists so that law enforcement officers and others in dangerous jobs who, he said, quote, make a little mistake, unquote, won't face the threat of being sued, losing their job, or facing other potential consequences, such as bankruptcy. Senator Garrett said, even if we have that small little risk that they might make a mistake, it's still better to have somebody there than to have nobody there. That's certainly my opinion anyway. I would much rather have an armed security guard at a school if my kid was there and the students were being threatened, unquote. The state's largest school districts, those with 8,000 or more students, would be required to employ school resource officers in high schools unless the district school board votes to opt out. School districts with fewer than 8,000 students would be encouraged to employ school resource officers. The Iowa Senate version of the bill removes language that would have created grant programs to fund school resource officers and school security.
Final story from today's front page. GOP lawmakers push to make it harder to raise income taxes. This story by Galen Basharier. Iowa legislators moved a step closer Wednesday toward making it much more difficult to raise income taxes in the state. State senators on Wednesday approved a proposed constitutional amendment that would require a two-thirds vote to approve income tax increases and help deter efforts to reverse Republican-led tax cuts passed in recent years. It would apply to proposed changes to the state's individual and corporate income tax rates, as well as rates on legal or special reserves. Currently, all legislation is approved through a simple majority, 50% plus one vote. The Senate's passage marks a key step toward putting the questions to voters on a future ballot, referring the proposal to next year's legislative session. If it is again approved by both chambers in either 2025 or 2026, it will go before the voters and could be approved by a simple majority at the ballot box. House Joint Resolution 2006 was approved by a 31-13 vote in the upper chamber after passing on a party-line vote in the House. Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican of Council Bluffs, said, "We don't have a bill that can correct the monetary and spending malfeasance of Washington, D.C., but what we can do, what we should do, is let people have a little bit more of a say whether or not it's harder to raise their taxes, to steal the money out of their pockets and put it in the coffers of government." Democrats said the amendment, if approved, would effectively bar any increase to income tax while shifting the tax burden onto lower-income Iowans. Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat of Davenport, asked, "Where do you think we'll go to balance the budgets? A yes vote on this resolution means higher property taxes, higher sales taxes, new fees, and fines in government." And Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat of Des Moines, argued that Republicans were being selective in which policies they chose to put to a public vote, specifically referencing a potential amendment on the right to abortion. Dawson pushed back on Democrats' criticism of the bills. He said, "This does not freeze the income tax for the wealthy. This does not shift taxes anywhere. It simply says there has to be a higher standard of threshold to raise the income tax." A separate amendment proposal approved by the Senate last week would require Iowa to have a flat individual income tax rate. Senate Joint Resolution 2004, which is now advancing through the House after passing the upper chamber on a party-line vote, would forbid a graduated income tax system with multiple rates based on income level. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law in 2022 that will take Iowa to a flat income tax rate of 3.9% by 2026. The state's top rate this year is 5.7% and will drop to a 4.82% next year unless lawmakers make further changes.
And we'll move to page 3A of today's Des Moines Register with the headline, Anti-Abortion Program Sees Changes Under Recently Signed Law, a story by Galen McCarrier. Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Wednesday a bill making several adjustments to her program that sends state money to anti-abortion pregnancy resource centers across Iowa. The More Options for Maternal Support, or MOMS, program funnels money to centers that counsel women against abortion, offer donated items for new mothers, and conduct family planning classes and other services. After twice failing to hire a third-party administrator to oversee the MOMS program, lawmakers opted to allow the state's Department of Health and Human Services to do so. The department has overseen the program on an interim basis. Under this new law, a third-party administrator is no longer required, and any administrator hired would no longer need 3 years of experience in Iowa to meet qualifications. The state's first search for an administrator garnered one applicant that failed to meet the requirements. The second search yielded no responsive bidders. The bill makes changes to the MOMS program passed The bill making changes to MOMS passed the House and Senate on party line votes. Republicans expressed support that the department could oversee the program, praising the centers as a key resource. Representative Michael Bergen, a Republican from Dorchester, said, "These entities provide necessary safety nets to women in need who want to bring their child into the world." Democrats have criticized both the veracity of the pregnancy resource centers, proposing unsuccessful amendments to require ultrasounds to be performed by licensed medical providers, and for the resource centers to prominently display if they are not licensed. And Democrats questioned the MOMS program's efficacy after two unsuccessful searches for an administrator. Representative Heather Mattson, a Democrat from Ankeny, said, "I see the failure to find a suitable administrator as a time when we should reflect on the viability of the program that will send taxpayer dollars to pregnancy resource centers," unquote. Lawmakers have allocated $2 million to the MOMS program, and the state has selected four centers to receive state funding.
And two short stories from page 4A. Police ID 30-year-old killed in shooting at Ramada. Des Moines police have identified the man killed at a hotel near the airport Wednesday as 30-year-old Savon Props of Des Moines. Another person, a 31-year-old Des Moines man, was hospitalized and remains in critical condition, according to a Thursday news release from Sergeant Paul Parisik, spokesperson with the Des Moines Police Department. Police believe there was an exchange of gunfire in the hotel room, which led to both victims' injuries. The release did not say who is believed to have fired the shots. The Des Moines Police Department and Des Moines Fire Department officials were dispatched to Ramada by Wyndham Des Moines Airport, 1810 Army Post Road, for a shooting at around 4:30 a.m. Wednesday. They found the two victims upon arrival. Props had died at the scene, and the injured person was taken to a local hospital. This is the city's second homicide case of the year, both happening within the last 8 days. EMT warned after patient death for failure to give CPR. This story by Clark Kaufman from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The state has issued a Lee County emergency medical technician a warning for failing to administer CPR to a patient who subsequently died. According to records of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, on January 26, EMT Heather Fraze of Lee County Emergency Medical Services responded to a 911 call for a patient who was in cardiac arrest. The department alleges that Fraze of Donaldson failed to initiate cardiopulmonary resuscitation on her arrival, failed to provide treatment for an irregular heartbeat, and failed to contact online medical direction to terminate resuscitation. According to Lee County EMS Director Mark Long, the patient did not survive. He said Fraze's employment with the service ended a short time later. DHHS Bureau of Emergency Medical and Trauma Services charged Fraze with violating rules related to negligence in performing emergency medical care. deviations from the standards of skill applied to Iowa emergency medical care providers, failure to exercise the degree of care ordinarily exercised by the average EMS provider, and failure to conform to the minimal standard of praxis. The department issued Fraze a warning and required her to complete a class in cardiovascular life support and take 3 hours of instruction on interpreting EKGs plus 3 hours of education in professional ethics. According to state records, Fraze has been an EMS provider for at least 20 years. In an unrelated matter, the Bureau of Emergency Medical and Trauma Services filed the Wadena Elyria First Responders, an EMS service program located in Fayette County, for repeatedly failing to report data on the services it provides as required by Iowa law. The Bureau notified the program that it was late in reporting data or had reported no data at all on 5 occasions in 2023, and a letter of warning was sent in December 2023. The Bureau imposed a $250 fine.
Headline, judge says Iowa police officer is entitled to unemployment. A story by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch and on page 4A of today's Des Moines Register. A Sioux Center police officer who was forced to resign after a domestic abuse arrest, a charge that was later dismissed, and a failed psychological test is entitled to unemployment benefits, a judge has ruled. According to state records, Steve Topete, who spells his last name T-O-P-E-T-E, began working for the city of Sioux Center as a full-time police officer in June of 2023. When he was hired, he was required to take and pass the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, which is a 600-question survey designed to measure an individual's integrity, character, and suitability as a law enforcement officer, with the answers reviewed by a psychologist. All certified law enforcement officers in Iowa are required to take the test. State records indicate Topete's test results were inconclusive, and so he took the test a second time in July of 2023 and passed. Later, Sioux Center Human Resources and Safety Manager Josh Mork met with officials at the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy to seek a resolution to a personnel matter of some kind that involved Topete. The ILEA then ordered Topete to undergo another psychological test. According to state records, Topete failed that test, which meant that he was no longer qualified to work as a certified police officer in Iowa. The city then gave Topete the choice of resigning or being fired, after which Topete submitted a letter of resignation. He subsequently collected unemployment benefits in the amount of $3,570. The city of Sioux Center appealed that decision to pay unemployment, which led to a hearing before Administrative Law Judge Elizabeth Johnson. At the hearing, Mork conceded that he had told Topete that he'd be discharged if he did not resign. Johnson, the Administrative Law Judge, noted that when an employee quits under those circumstances, their departure cannot be considered voluntary. As for whether Topete had committed the sort of willful workplace misconduct that would disqualify him from collecting unemployment, the administrative law judge ruled that while passing the psychological test might be considered a requirement of the job, failing the test does not suggest willful misconduct. Johnson stated in her ruling, "This is not the type of exam someone can study or prepare for. The examinee either has the necessary attributes at the time of the exam or they don't." Topete was ruled eligible for unemployment benefits. Court records indicate that several weeks before he was forced to resign, on October 1st of 2023, Topete was arrested on a charge of domestic abuse assault. Police allege he assaulted a juvenile female by grabbing her wrist, causing minor visible injuries, and pushing her up a set of stairs, causing her to fall forward, resulting in additional injuries. Topete also was accused of kicking the girl in the knee. Jason D. Bring, the assistant county attorney in Plymouth County, was named special prosecutor in the case on October 6th of last year. 12 days later, Bring filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing a lack of evidence. District Associate Judge Jessica Knoll issued the dismissal order the same day.
We turn now to the Metro and Iowa News section. There are four stories on page one. Iowa expands kids' summer meal program. Year's first safe haven babies born in March. Who gets credit for inventing modern tractors? And board picks Snowgren to lead Perry High, citing his extremely effective job as interim principal. And here is the first story. Iowa expands kids' summer meal program. This story by F. Amanda Tugad. Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Department of Education announced a new plan Wednesday to help school districts and community organizations feed youth in need during the summer. Through the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant, $900,000 in competitive grants are now up for grabs for local groups seeking to offer healthy meals and snacks to children and teens over summer break, according to a news release. The latest initiative comes nearly 3 months after Reynolds drew criticism from anti-hunger leaders on her decision to opt out of the federal government-run summer EBT program for low-income families. Iowa is one of 17 states that declined to participate in the summer EBT program this year, effectively turning down around $29 million in federal food aid for low-income families in the form of grocery debit cards. Reynolds, a Republican, pointed to the state being in the top 10 in the nation for high school age obesity and said EBT programs don't have a strong enough focus on nutrition. The latest initiative from the governor and the State Department is a supplement to the federal dollars organizations already receive through the Summer Food Service Program and Seamless Summer Option, two nutrition programs headed by the United States Department of Agriculture. Reynolds said in a news release, providing young Iowans with access to free, nutritious meals in their communities during the summer months has always been a priority. With the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant, we will expand these well-established programs across our state to ensure Iowa's youth have meals that are healthy and use local community farms and vendors when possible. But Democratic Senator Sarah Trone-Garriott said the state's new grant program is tiny compared to the $29 million it could have received from the federal summer EBT program. She said these are crumbs for Iowa kids and forces Iowa communities to compete for a sliver of that much smaller pie. She went on to say, it is not enough to meet the real needs facing our state, and it does not make up for her decision to let Iowa kids go hungry. Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat of Cedar Rapids, also voiced concerns over the effort, calling the program a labyrinth of red tape, a convoluted mess, and a clear downgrade from the aid provided by summer EBT. He believes the plan fails to guarantee that children will be fed. Sheets said in a lengthy statement, it relies heavily on local organizations to step up and fill gaps, demanding that they jump through hoops for funding that still might not meet all logistical needs, especially in rural or undeserved areas. We are trading a direct, proven method for fighting hunger with a scattered approach that leaves too much to chance and too many children behind. According to the news release, the grant program is funded by American Rescue Plan Act dollars. Applications are open through end of day May 7 for schools, nonprofits, community organizations, and local governments. Prospective new meal sites must be located in an area where at least 50% or more of the children are eligible for free or reduced price meals. Priority consideration will be given to applicants that establish a new open meal site where all children ages 18 and younger are served. For details, go to iowagrants.gov.
And a story across the bottom of the Metro and Iowa section, board picks Snowgren to lead Perry High School, citing his extremely effective job as interim principal. The story by Allison Ullman of the Des Moines Register. Brad Snowgren will move from interim principal to principal of Perry High School starting July 1. The school board approved his appointment during a special meeting on Wednesday. Board members worked with Grundmeier Leader Services and Ray & Associates Incorporated to conduct a search. The rival Iowa search firms partnered at no cost to help find a successor to Perry High School principal Dan Marburger, who died of wounds suffered in the January 4th shootings at Perry High School. Dylan Butler, a 17-year-old Perry High student, killed 11-year-old Amir Jolliffe and wounded seven other people, including Marburger, before taking his own life. Marburger, who police say tried to intervene to protect students, died 10 days later. He served in the Perry School District for nearly 30 years, first as associate principal in 1995, then as principal beginning in 1997. Before the board approved Snowgren's appointment, Marburger's family spoke during Wednesday's open forum. While Hannah Pierce understands that her dad cannot and will not be replaced, she said, "I'm probably biased. My dad loved this place so much he gave his life protecting it and his people. We just want to make sure due diligence has been done to ensure that Perry High School has the best candidate that will carry on his qualities." School Superintendent Clark Wicks said during Wednesday's meeting that Grundmeier Leader Services and Ray & Associates Incorporated cast a wide net and came up with 13 applicants. The two search firms told Wicks that the average is 12 for the high school principal position. After reviewing the 13 applicants, the number was reduced to 6. Those 6 answered questions through video, Wicks said, and the number was then narrowed to 3. He said around 37 people participated in the interview team, including students, parents, teachers, and community members. After going through the results from the interview process, Wicks recommended Snowgren to serve as the next high school principal. He said, "We wanted to be able to have a person that we feel could handle this extremely challenging situation." Wicks said, "Since January 4th, I feel that Mr. Snowgren has been able to do an extremely effective job connecting with the students, connecting with staff, and doing a job in which nobody else would realize how difficult the situation is." The district said in a statement that Snowgren has overseen the daily operations of the high school building in his role as interim principal since January 4th. He has assisted in extracurricular activities, helped manage facilities, and consulted on the building's construction and remodeling project for reopening. In a statement, Snowgren said that he is deeply honored and humbled to lead Perry High School. He said, "As principal, I look forward to guiding our students towards success in both academics and character development." Snowgren previously served as the associate principal of Perry High School for over 6 years and began his career in education as a high school physical education and health teacher in the Fairfield Community School District.
Who gets credit for inventing modern tractors? John Deere predecessor got off to a slow start. This story by Kevin Baskins. In 1890, John Froelich had a mechanized method of threshing grain available to him. It just wasn't a good one. Beyond horses, steam was the main source of agricultural propulsion then. It posed some significant challenges to Froelich, who operated a grain elevator and mobile threshing service in the northeast Iowa town that bore his family name. Fed up with the difficulty of moving heavy, steam-powered equipment around Iowa and the Dakotas, Froelich ended up revolutionizing agriculture with what is now a standard fixture everywhere in rural America, the gasoline-powered tractor. Not only was Froelich's invention lighter, more maneuverable, more economical, and safer, it had one more feature added to its functionality. It could go in reverse. It was Froelich's early endeavor to the world of mechanized farming that would later morph into the green and yellow standard bearer of the tractor world, John Deere. With the aid of his blacksmith, Froelich mounted a one-cylinder gas engine on his steam engine's running gear. The result was a tractor able to cross the fields at 3 miles per hour. Froelich's invention was soon put to the test and passed with flying colors. On its annual harvest tour, his team was able to thresh more than 1,000 bushels a day, 72,000 bushels in all, on just 26 gallons of gas. Perhaps the greatest achievement was what the new tractor did not do, start fires. One of the major risks of steam engines at the time was of a wayward spark igniting a fire that would spread quickly across the windblown prairies. Froelich's early attempts at achieving commercial success with his tractor, however, were met with challenges. In 1894, he and eight investors formed the Waterloo Gasoline Traction Engine Company, but dissatisfied owners returned the two tractors it initially sold. The company turned to manufacturing stationary engines, including one that powered a printing press at the Waterloo Courier. Froelich's interest, however, remained with farming equipment, and he ultimately left the company in 1895. The Waterloo Company kept working on improving the tractor, and although it sold only 20 units in 18 years, it hit pay dirt in 1914 with its introduction of the Waterloo Boy, a single-speed tractor that boasted sales of 118 in its first year. The company followed the next year with a two-speed model that sold even more. Moline, Illinois-based John Deere, known primarily for its steel-bottom plows, bought Waterloo Gasoline Traction Engine Company in 1918 for $2.4 million, or more than $50 million at current prices. After leaving the tractor business in 1895, Froelich moved his family to Dubuque, where he worked for a number of years with various engine manufacturing companies before developing a clothes washing machine that brought him even greater prosperity. The factory Deere bought endures to this day as the company's Waterloo Works, the world's largest tractor production facility.
The year's first Safe Haven babies born in Iowa in March. One boy, one girl in Department of Health and Human Services custody awaiting homes. This story by Jose Mendiola of the Register. Two babies born in March have been declared Safe Haven babies, the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services said on Wednesday. A baby girl born on March 17th and a baby boy born March 20th, who are now in the custody of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, will be placed with foster families until a permanent home is found. There have been 68 infants surrendered to the state since the law went into effect more than two decades ago. Under Iowa law, a parent or someone with a parent's permission may leave an infant up to 90 days old at a hospital or healthcare facility without fear of legal action for abandonment. A parent also can call 911 and give the baby to a first responder. Parents who relinquish their children under the Safe Haven Act are not required to give identification. Iowa's Safe Haven Act has been in place since 2002, after a teenager in Chelsea gave birth and left her dead newborn in a snowbank the year before. Iowa Health and Human Services Director Kelly Garcia said, "I want parents to know that they have this safe and trusted option at such a critical time in their lives. Accessing Safe Haven is assuredly not an easy decision, but this law," she said, "exists to protect newborns, and its success is evident by the number of families who have trusted in the Safe Haven Act." The goal for state officials is to protect newborns and provide them with the best permanent home possible, Garcia said. 10 infants were given to the Department of Health and Human Services last year. These have been the only babies surrendered so far in 2024. Those interested in becoming a foster parent or adopting a child in Iowa can go to iowafosterandadoption.org. Again, it's iowafosterandadoption.org.
Teen charged with shooting man with 3D printed handgun. This story by Jose Mendiola. A 16-year-old was arrested and charged with attempted murder for allegedly shooting a man with a 3D-printed handgun Tuesday morning, police said. The Des Moines Police Department and the Des Moines Fire Department were dispatched to the 4100 block of Easton Boulevard for a shooting at around 8:35 a.m. Tuesday, police spokesperson Sergeant Paul Perezik said in a news release Wednesday. A 31-year-old man was found shot and was taken to a hospital, Perezik said. The victim was still in the hospital in serious condition as of Wednesday afternoon. Officers were given a description of the alleged shooter and found a person that matched it nearby in a car, Perezik said. They took the suspect into custody without incident. Investigators found that the shooting stemmed from an argument between people that knew each other, Perezik said. Detectives found two 3D-printed handguns by the scene, and the source of those handguns is being investigated. Police believe the 16-year-old used the 3D-printed guns in the shooting, Perezik said. He was charged in adult court. According to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, people generally can make firearms, including 3D-printed weapons, for personal use. However, they cannot manufacture them for sale or distribution without a license and cannot violate the National Firearms Act or other laws. In Iowa, it is illegal for anyone under 21 to have a handgun.
Former Whiskey River bartender Suze alleges that she was fired after calling 911 during a fight. This story by Chris Higgins of the Des Moines Register. A former bartender at Whiskey River, a bar and grill in Ankeny's Prairie Trail neighborhood, has filed a lawsuit alleging she was wrongfully fired after she called 911 for help during a bloody bar fight. Taylor Schaller is suing the companies that employed her at Whiskey River in Ankeny and Founders Irish Pub in Bon Durant, the owner Joseph Romera, and one of her supervisors in a Polk County District Court lawsuit filed March 29th. Schaller alleges that she was wrongfully discharged after she called 911 during a violent late-night brawl at Whiskey River in November of last year because she says it was against company policy to call police to the bar. Schaller said in a statement to the Des Moines Register, "When this happened, I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was being punished for trying to keep people safe when I was only doing what I thought was the right thing to do. I felt like people were in danger and needed to act for their safety as well as my own. I never thought I would lose my job for it." Whiskey River did not respond to email seeking comment and could not be reached by phone. A lawyer with a firm representing Whiskey River in other matters said it has not been retained in this case and could not speak on the bar's behalf. Schaller was working a shift scheduled to go through the early morning hours of November 18th last year. She was a reliable employee who had received no negative evaluations. Hang on one second here. It's my iPad. Takes on a life of its own. Okay. One moment. I love technology. Let me get back to where I was here. Schaller was working a shift scheduled to go through the early morning of November 18th. She was a reliable employee who had received no negative evaluation of her job performance, the lawsuit says. Shortly before 1 a.m. on November 18, 2023, a fight broke out between customers at the bar, according to the lawsuit, and that turned into a brawl involving multiple patrons and staff members who tried to intervene. One witness described seeing blood everywhere from the fight. The brawl deteriorated to the point that a bouncer used pepper spray into the crowd, including on both customers and staff. Again, this is according to the lawsuit. Schaller says that she then heard someone say, "I have a gun." Fearing for the safety of customers and staff, she called 911 at 12:57 a.m. to have law enforcement de-escalate the situation. A co-worker approached her while she was making the call and said the only person allowed to call 911 was one of the managers who was in the middle of the brawl, the lawsuit says. Schaller responded facetiously while still in sincere concern for her own safety and the safety of employees. She said, according to the lawsuit, "They can fire me. I'm not going to have people pepper sprayed and not call 911. According to the lawsuit, Ankeny Police and Ankeny Fire Department medics arrived, and multiple people were treated for injuries. The Register has requested incident reports related to the brawl from the Ankeny Police Department. Later, when she was cleaning after the incident, Romare approached her area and asked who called the police. Schaller said that she did to ensure the safety of staff and customers. Romare told her never call the cops, according to the lawsuit. Schaller finished her shift. She expected to work another shift at Founders later on November 18th, but found herself locked out of the scheduling software. Schaller called her supervisor to ask why. The supervisor responded that it seemed there was a situation last night and that it was best to just part ways, the lawsuit says. The supervisor told her it was Whiskey River policy to not call police to the bar and that she didn't follow it. Schaller was terminated. Shaler's attorney, Grant Rogers, said in a statement, "Sometimes employees have to take action in the workplace to protect themselves or the public, even though doing so might be contrary to their employer's best interests. The doctrine of wrongful termination in violation of public policy exists to make sure that when employees undertake these actions, they are not retaliated against by their employer, and to offer legal recourse if they do suffer retaliation. We look forward to providing Taylor's claim in court," unquote. Shaler is accusing the defendants of wrongful discharge in violation of public policy and Iowa law. She is seeking damages for lost pay, emotional distress, and other losses.
Two short stories here. I-80 closure plan between Waukee and West Des Moines. This story by Philip Sitter. There will be an overnight closure and detour on eastbound Interstate 80 next week on the western end of the Des Moines Metro as crews remove sign trusses. Eastbound I-80 will be closed, weather permitting, from 10 p.m. Wednesday, April 17 to 4 a.m. Thursday, April 18, between Grand Prairie Parkway and Jordan Creek Parkway, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. During the closure, a marked detour will take drivers on a route using Grand Prairie Parkway, exit 118, University Avenue, and Jordan Creek Parkway, exit 121. IDOT asks drivers to proceed with caution, obey the posted speed limit and other signs in the work area, stay alert, leave plenty of space between vehicles, and wear seatbelts. Traffic fines for moving violations are at least double in work zones. The latest travel information is available at 511IA.org or by calling 511 in Iowa or 800-288-1047 nationwide. Email and text alerts are also available at new511ia.org login. And Des Moines Hilton Garden Inn unveils renovations by Philip Jones. A DoubleTree hotel near Des Moines International Airport has been remodeled and turned into a Hilton Garden Inn, according to the hotel's franchisee. Located at 6800 Floor Drive, the hotel was reconstructed to upgrade it. Mike Whalen, founder of Des Moines franchisee Heart of America Group, said in a news release, "It is about a mile south of the airport's entrance." Heart of America owns hotels in Iowa, Kansas, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. The company also is developing the Tempo and Aston apartment buildings in the East Village and owns local restaurants, including the Republic on Grand and the Machine Shed. An existing Johnny's Italian Steakhouse restaurant remains at the hotel, according to the news release.
Moving to some national news now from the USA Today, Trump says that he would not sign a federal abortion ban. This story on page 6A of the Des Moines Register. Former President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he would not sign a federal abortion ban if he's elected to a second term, and reiterated that states should handle the issue, even as he criticized an Arizona court decision reinstating a law that completely bans the procedure except in life-threatening emergencies. The statement followed some questions after Trump said in a video released on Monday that restrictions on abortion access should be left up to the states. 2 days later, the former president further clarified his position on a federal abortion law, saying no when asked if he would sign a federal ban. Trump told reporters after landing in Atlanta for a fundraiser, "As you know, it's all about states' rights." Trump hasn't said which state-level abortion restrictions he supports, but he has made clear he believes abortion is an issue that favors Democrats in a tight election year. Trump also responded to a question about whether Arizona went too far on abortion restrictions by declaring, "Yeah, they did." He added, "It'll be straightened out, and I'm sure that the governor and everybody else are going to bring it back into reason." The former president also continued to tout the fact that his conservative U.S. Supreme Court appointees were key in overturning Roe v. Wade, the decision that had protected abortion rights from coast to coast. Trump said on Wednesday, "For 52 years, people have wanted to end Roe v. Wade to get it back to the states. We did that." Supporters of President Joe Biden said Trump is creating a smokescreen, seeking to reassure moderates by downplaying a federal ban while placating his political base by tacitly supporting state efforts to target reproductive rights, even as he criticizes some of their more draconian measures. said Biden campaign spokesman Michael Tyler. The guy who wants to be a dictator on day one will use every tool at his disposal to ban abortion nationwide, with or without Congress. The recent Arizona Supreme Court ruling reinstating an 1864 abortion ban shows how the issue could continue to bedevil Trump. Many states have pursued aggressive restrictions on abortion in the wake of Roe's demise, including Florida, which passed a ban on the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Asked about Florida's law Wednesday, Trump said, "Florida's probably maybe gonna change also."